Good afternoon. Welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. If you'll all take your seats, please. Rosa, if you'd please call the roll.
Chair McLean.
Here.
Vice Chair Buchanan.
Here.
Majority Whip Lamarcus.
Here.
Ranking Member Escalante.
I am here.
Representatives Alvarez.
Here, ma'am.
Bankson. Bankson. Barnaby.
Here.
Burfield.
Here.
Campbell.
Here.
Caruso.
Here.
Casello, excused. Duggan, excused. Fabricio.
Here.
Hart. Holcomb.
Here.
Killebrew.
Yes, ma'am.
Rayner. Roach.
Present.
Robinson.
Here.
Roth.
Here.
Saroy.
Here.
Smith.
Here.
Tant.
Here.
Valdez.
I'm present.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, I don't really have any other than good afternoon to everyone. Let's get right into it. The first bill that we'll hear this morning is House Bill 1195, Millage Rates, by Representative Garrison. Representative Garrison, you are recognized to present your bill.
Thank you, Chairman, and good afternoon, members. Colleagues, in 2018, the voters of the state, by a 66-34 margin, approved a constitutional amendment requiring a supermajority of each house of the legislature in order to raise taxes or fees. Over the last 4 years, we've honored the people's will and operated under the constitutional premise that tax increases should only be considered as a last resort and require broad, oftentimes bipartisan, consensus. This is consistent with our state's tradition of limited government, low taxes, and responsible fiscal stewardship. HB 1195 applies this principle to the areas of local government closest to the people, specifically our counties, municipalities, and special districts, by prohibiting an increase in the millage rate from going into effect unless and until it's been approved by a two-third vote of the governing body authorizing the increase. Mr. Chairman, that is the bill, and there is a technical amendment.
Thank you. Representative Garrison, having explained his bill, members, are there questions on the bill? There is an amendment, but you're certainly welcome to ask questions on the bills presented. Representative Valdez, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and hi, Rep. Garrison.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My question is that can you clarify in your bill, because there's mathematically there's a difference when you say two-thirds versus supermajority, so which one is it going to be? Is it going to be a two-thirds, or is it the supermajority?
The terms are synonymous as far as I'm concerned, two-thirds.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you be willing to do an amendment to clarify through that it'll be two-thirds rather than using the two-thirds or the supermajority and change it for clarity?
Recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking at the bill language, I believe it says two-thirds. So it's already taken care of in the text of the bill.
Representative Hart, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Representative. Would you consider delaying this to 2026, putting it into law in 2026?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll consider anything, but at this point, I'm not inclined to do so.
Representative Hart, do you have a follow? Okay. Representative Campbell, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, Representative Garrison. My question is in regards to the need for this bill. What is occurring now for the implementation of this bill?
Recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm glad you asked. I represent local governments for a living. It's my profession. So this is one of those rare instances where someone goes to Tallahassee and puts up a bill that's against their professional interests. I will tell you from my perspective, this is purely a belief. I won't say a philosophical bill, but this bill to me is something that's always bothered me before I got to the legislature. I think all we've known since I've come to Tallahassee in 2020 is that it takes two-thirds to raise taxes. The voters, by an overwhelming majority, supermajority of the voters, actually, made it very clear that that's their expectation of their government officials when taxes are raised. But as it relates to ad valorem or property taxes, which we all pay, and which in the spectrum of taxes are the form of taxes that are most burdensome on those elders and our seniors who live on fixed incomes, often pensioners whose cost of living doesn't go up along with the proportionate increase in the value of their property, those taxes can be raised by a simple majority. It's never made sense to me. And so for that reason, this is something that I believe is consistent with our state's principles and certainly with the will of the voters that was expressed There's no specific example that I'm trying to correct. This is just a broad-based approach to where I believe personally, and I think many members of this legislature do, that if you're going to raise property taxes, it should, number one, be as a last resort, and number two, require a broad, oftentimes bipartisan consensus that it's the right thing to do for the community, because the impact on our citizens is so profound, much more than what we do oftentimes up here in Tallahassee. So for that reason, I believe this is the right bill.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regards to the impacts, do you see any impact of this bill on, or what would be the impacts on this bill on public education?
You're recognized.
I think there would be little to no impact. I mean, the reality of it is nothing in this bill impacts the ability of local governments, be it on the municipalities, counties, special districts, it doesn't decrease their ability to raise revenue or raise your taxes, your ad valorem taxes. All it says is that instead of having a simple bare majority, you have to have a two-thirds majority. Again, the same principles that the voters put on us in 2018, it applies to them. So it does not cap their ability or in any way restrict the ability they have now to raise revenue. It just says if you're going to do that, if you're going to raise the tax rate, you have to have a consensus to do so.
No further questions at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Fabricio, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for bringing this great bill. Phenomenal. I support it ardently. My only question is I just want to make sure the intent of it is to include counties such as Miami-Dade County.
You're recognized. He wants that on the record.
Well, I'm often, I'll save my joke. Yes, it applies to all 67 counties of this great state.
Thank you.
Representative Tant, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Representative, quick question.
Yes, ma'am.
I was about to call you Mr. Speaker. Sorry about that. So quick question in logistics. So in Leon, we have a county commission and a city commission. Do they both have to agree with the same margin vote on a tax increase?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Tant. No, what this would do, it would be, for those who don't do this for a living, I'm going to answer your question with a little bit of an explanation. So state law lays out in painstaking detail the process that is laid out by which ad valorem or property taxes are collected. There's a very detailed notice process. If the municipality is raising above the rollback rate, and specific notices with certain disclaimers have to be presented to the people, mailed to the property owners. This doesn't change any of it. So if you have a situation, let's say Leon County and Tallahassee or Orange Park and Clay County, let's use that as an example. Both of those taxing districts have the ability to raise ad valorem taxes by virtue of their status as either a county or a municipality. So when you get your tax bill, you get your Tallahassee taxes, which I understand went up last year a little bit, and you also get your Leon County taxes, and they're different ad valorem rates, and you get them both as part of the unified method as part of your tax bill. Those rates, while the taxpayer pays them as a lump sum, they are set separately by the respective bodies, and so that would not change one bit. So let's say, for example, the town of Orange Park decided it wanted to raise its ad valorem rate. They would have the ability to do that if this bill would pass with a two-thirds majority. Let's say Clay County didn't want to keep them the same, did not want to raise them. They would just do the standard. You would not need consensus from both. It would be just that local government agency that controls and sets the rates that would have to approve by that margin. It's a long answer, but I hope it kind of clarifies a little bit.
Ranking Member Escamani, you're recognized for a question.
Thanks so much, Chair, and great to see you, Representative.
Likewise, Ranking Member.
My very first question has to do with how your bill works in conjunction with existing law. So as you noted, in 2007, legislature put into place restrictions on the millage rate increases. And so local governments already face some requirements when it comes to such improvements with the maximum millage rate in mind, including two-thirds. So I'm curious, how would your bill work with current law that local governments already face?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendment, which we'll handle right after this, makes clear that none of those existing conditions would be modified at all by this bill. So this bill would not affect the requirement, would not affect the 110% cap. It would not affect the need for a 75% super majority above certain levels. So the amendment will address that.
Follow-up, Chair?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So thank you for that clarity. So you are creating a third requirement in addition to the two that already exist, and maybe walk me through if that's accurate and why.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wouldn't call it that. I'd just say it's a new baseline for raising ad valorem taxes. So when the local government, when the city of Orlando decides they're going to put together they're going to adopt their millage rate for the year, the process would not change one iota. The only difference would be if they make a decision that they are going to increase the actual millage rate. Doing so would not just require, I don't know how many members are on the commission in Orlando, but let's just say there's nine.
Right.
Doing so would not require five votes. It would require that two-thirds majority. So all it says, the process doesn't change. All it says is if you're going to raise that rate, right now it's a bare majority. Going forward, it would require two-thirds.
Okay. Follow-up, Chair, if I can.
Recognize.
Thank you so much. Forgive me if this question was already asked. I don't think it was, so just let me know if it was. So one reason why local governments, you know, visit the millage rate is that they're trying to compete on the private sector when it comes to labor. Whether it's police, fire, utilities, it's a very competitive market out there. And so they might do a slight increase to be competitive in that regard. What would the impact of your bill be if they're just trying to, you know, pay their law enforcement officers a rate to attract them from the sheriff's office, for example?
You recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think a lot depends on what the market's doing. So this does not apply, this does not deal with revenue. So if you have your millage rate set at a set level and your property value has increased, you're going to reap additional revenue on the basis of that same amount. We're not in this bill requiring people to go back to the rollback rate at all. This just says if you're going to increase the actual rate, the percentage of someone's property value that you're going to tax them, not the net value, but the actual percentage, if you're going to increase that percentage, it requires two-thirds. I would also point out that this bill actually is much more limited in scope than what the voters put on us. Our requirement is for taxes and fees. I'm not saying that local governments should have to do that. Your garbage costs what it costs to pick up, and local governments are not allowed to go beyond just the cost of recouping those costs. That's why it's called a fee and not a tax. I think that there's a different situation there. We're talking simply about the property tax or ad valorem rate that's established and that alone. So I don't think that the concern you're raising I don't think would be an issue for me, and certainly that's not the intent, and I don't think that would be a problem.
Okay. Another follow-up, Chair, if I may?
You recognize.
Thank you. One of the feedbacks we heard from Legal Cities, and I know they've spoken to, and they'll be here today, I'm sure, has to do with property values when they go down, which is inevitable, right? They fluctuate. And so property values go down, so your revenue goes down, but your expenses may stay the same.
Yep.
And so how does your bill interact with that? And would you be amenable to some amendment that, you know, provides an exception for those type of situations? They're not trying to make more money. They're just trying to sustain what the budget requires at that time.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I spoke with the league at length, and we're going to continue to have some discussions. There's not a guarantee in life that property values go up. I mean, recessions are real. We saw in 2008, if we learned nothing from that, is that what goes up oftentimes does come down. Two things I would say. Number one, as it exists right now, the whole point of ad valorem is if your property values go down, your ad valorem goes down. Nothing in this bill would prohibit local governments, if they feel it's necessary to provide for core services, from raising their ad valorem rate to hold their value steady. You can still do that. We're not saying you can't raise taxes. All we're saying is if you're going to do it, you have to have a broad consensus of your governing body that's the right thing to do. You can't just jam it through with a bare majority. Sir, I'd be happy to discuss with the league. I understand their concerns. The problem I have that is, I'll just tell you with that issue, is that if you have a situation where you raise the rate when property values are down, well, when they go up, they really go up, and the taxpayer, you know, bears the brunt of that. So we'll have those discussions. I think my in general, I would say, though, to my friends in local government, one of the oldest tales in the Bible is 7 years of plenty, 7 years of want. You know, the good times don't always last. And so it's important when you're doing your budgeting to kind of plan for the fact that those property values are not always going to go up. And most of our folks do a great job of that, and we understand it. But it's just good to realize and recognize that, you know, if you have a recessionary situation and you're going to raise the property taxes so that the revenue stays the same, understand that many of your citizens are hurting in that situation. So that same tax bill, what might be the same dollar amount, matters a lot more if you don't have a job than if the economy is humming.
I just have two quick follow-ups, Chair, if that's okay.
Okay.
Thank you. You mentioned, you know, planning ahead, which I definitely agree with you. But there are circumstances where, for example, legislature passes an unfunded mandate down to local governments. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes the military might be connected to an unfunded mandate. Would you be open to an amendment that provides an exception for unfunded mandates from the legislature?
You recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not particularly.
Okay. And then one last follow-up, Chair.
You recognize.
Thank you. I know you mentioned that this is, you know, an issue you care about, you know, from a philosophical perspective, but I couldn't help but notice that ALEC has very similar legislation called the Local Taxpayer Protection Act. I'm curious, did you work with ALEC on this, the idea come from ALEC, or is it just a coincidence that it's similar to that national model?
You recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wouldn't know that legislation if I ever saw it. The answer is absolutely not. This comes from the mind of Representative Sam Garrison from District 11. If you love it, I'll take credit for it. If you hate it, I'm to blame.
Members, were any questions? All right, seeing no further questions on the bill. There is an amendment to the bill. Representative Garrison, you are recognized to explain your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, as was discussed in my conversation with Representative Escamani, this amendment clarifies that this bill does not lessen the existing particular supermajority vote requirements in current law related to the adoption of a millage rate in excess of 110% of the rollbacked rate. And that, Mr. Chairman, that is the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Garrison, having explained his amendment. Are there questions on the amendment? Questions on the amendment? Seeing none, there are no amendments to the amendment. There is public testimony on the amendment, but I do want to make sure. Sal, are you on the bill? You want to be on the bill? Bill, yeah, okay. And then Bob, are you going to be on the bill as well? Okay, thank you. Just wanted to make sure. There is no public testimony. Is there any additional public testimony? Seeing none. Members, we are in debate on the amendment. Is there a debate on the amendment? Representative Garrison, you're recognized to close on your amendment.
Wait, Mr. Chair.
Are there any objections to the amendment? Without objection, so the amendment adopted. We are on the bill as amended. There is public testimony on the bill as amended. Sal Nuzzo. Thank you, Sal. Bob McKee, Florida Association of Counties. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Bob McKee with the Florida Association of Counties. Today I'm here for information, and the reason I'm speaking today is we do have, under current law, maximum millage rates that do key off, as Representative Garrison said, key off the rollback rate. One of the things that's important to understand about the rollback rate, first, it has always been used as the definition for a tax increase rather than the strict rate of taxation being defined. When we have to send a notice to the taxpayers about whether it's a tax rate increase or not in property taxes, it is all based off that rollback rate. That rollback rate is very important because it recognizes certain things within the complexity of our public finance system. For example, one of the things that gets excluded from the rollback at times is tax increment financing that the county, for example, has to pay to a municipality per statute. So if we have to make that payment, it recognizes that that's something state law requires us to do. It sets up a formula and we have to pay that municipality. I know there are circumstances, I think Bay County is one, and the city of Panama City Beach, where the increment is growing at a rapid pace, well above the countywide growth, and it's continuing to take more and more dollars away. We're concerned without recognition of things like that. It would force the county commission to take a two-thirds vote in order to maintain what essentially for their own purposes is the same level of funding, that the millage rate is being pushed up potentially by something external. Additionally, it's important to understand when you look at those under current law, local governments are given an incentive to not use all the capacity they have in a given year under the current system. There's a savings piece so that if they choose not to go up to the entirety of what law would allow them to do with a majority vote under current law, they get to save that capacity and potentially use it in a future year. We're concerned that this provision may give different incentives to local governments with regard to how they behave in the future. We think it's important to look at the existing system and see where it's working, and we look forward to working with Representative Garrison on that.
Thank you, Bob, for your comments. That is all of the public testimony that we have on the bill as amended. Is there anyone in the public that would like to speak? Seeing none. Members, we are in debate on the bill as amended. Representative Holcomb, you are recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a soft yes, and I want to talk to you through my split personalities here. So as a citizen, I like it. As a state representative, I've talked before about property taxes versus sales taxes, and that's my concern there. But as a former county commissioner, I am concerned about taking powers away from a duly elected official. Tallahassee has put in place increases to a budget each and every year, which, yes, revenues are increasing, but my county that I served in and probably many counties run pretty lean. And my concern is, how do you improve your parks? How do you fix your roads? How do you do your intersections and prisons and public safety? So that's where my concern is, but again, I'll be a yes, and I wish you luck.
Debate members in debate. Representative Campbell, you are recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I came in here on a yes, but it was brought up to me about my idea where I was looking at millage rates. And so, and with that being said, I had questions regarding the restrictive nature around it. For me personally, I always believe allowing the local government to handle it and make those best decisions for themselves. I have more questions and more concerns. I understand that you've been working on it. And so, I have all confidence in that you're going to work this through. And so for today, I'm down on this bill, but it's subject to change when it hits the floor. So I'm looking forward to the changes, and I'm looking forward to talking with you more about the effects and the long-term ramifications of it. So thank you.
Ranking Member Escamani, you are recognized.
Thank you so much. And I adore you, Representative Garrison. I think you're one of the best lawmakers here. And I do appreciate your expertise in local government, because I know that this is coming from a good place. I actually want to share in the concern that Representative Holcomb expressed. And so I love that. Just thinking about, the trust that local constituents put in local elected officials to make the tough calls. We do push a lot of unfunded mandates onto local governments, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that we have a lot of bills this session that impact local governments, several out of this committee. And so it does hit a point of, when is too much too much? When we're just like tightening our grip over local governments, where their ability to do anything is severely limited. And so I have a lot of concern where I see many bills that kind of have similar intentions passing at the same time, because it just creates a scenario where local governments are inevitably going to fail. And I don't want that. I want them to be good partners and stewards in the work that we're doing. And so I'm hopeful that some of these amendments we talked about could be added, maybe soften the effect to take in consideration some of these unique circumstances and situations. So I'll have to be a no today. But I do appreciate, your commitment to the taxpayer. I think that alone is something that in this committee we honor and we're grateful for. But I do worry about some of the consequences when we add a third requirement since two already exist. And of course, many of our homeowners have homestead exemptions, save our homes. There are also a lot of other mechanisms in place when it comes to reducing the tax burden on them. And so with that, I thank you for the time, Chair.
Representative Banks, and you are recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you for taking the time with me on this, again, serving at a local level. Those same concerns are there. And I think you stated it so clearly. This is not forbidding a local municipality, county, from making that choice. It's more really putting the standard high, such as you walk in the candy store and it all looks good and you're tempted to go ahead and buy that candy. This just makes it just holding that standard higher to say, let's not just go ahead and make that move unless it's genuinely necessary. And so this is not limiting it. It's just holding a high standard that should be there with responsibility to our taxpayers. So I am up on this bill.
Members in debate. Seeing no further debate, Representative Garrison, you are recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I look forward to the first Holcomb Escamani bill next year. We can all get behind and bring this chamber together. I would say, in all seriousness, Mr. Chairman, you hear a little passion in my voice on this bill, and it comes from an abiding conviction that our first responsibility as elected representatives is to the people we serve, and to those oftentimes without a voice to come up here and hire lobbyists and do the things that sometimes have to get done to get bills across the finish line. This bill is designed to protect the interests of the working men and women of this state who oftentimes are working paycheck to paycheck, their mortgage is high, they're worried about how they're gonna get through the challenges that exist. And what we're saying is not local governments, we don't wanna starve you to death, we don't want you to be able to raise taxes. What we're saying is the presumption is in favor of the taxpayer. And that's the operating principle that we've been working under as a legislature since the voters put that mandate on us in 2018. I think this bill strikes a nice balance between allowing local governments the ability to get the revenue necessary to provide core services, but also making it clear that if you're going to raise property taxes, you better have a darn good reason. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I close and ask for your favorable support.
Thank you. Representative Garrison, having closed on his bill, Rosa, please call the roll on House Bill 1195 and announce the vote.
Chair McClain?
Yes.
Vice Chair Buchanan?
Yes.
Majority Whip Lamarca?
Yes.
Ranking Member Escamani?
No.
Representatives Alvarez?
Yes.
Bankson? Bankson?
Yes.
Barnaby?
Yes.
Burfield?
Yes.
Campbell?
No.
Caruso?
Yes.
Casello? Duggan? Fabricio?
Yes.
Hart?
No.
Holcomb?
Yes.
Killebrew?
No, ma'am.
I'm sorry? No. Rainer?
No.
Roach?
Yes.
Robinson?
Yes.
Roth?
Yes.
Saroy? Yes. Smith?
Yes.
Tant?
No.
Valdez?
No.
Yeas, 7 nays.
Members, by your vote, we will show House Bill 1195 reported favorably. Congratulations, Representative Garrison.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, members.
Now, members, we will move on to House Bill 635. Sorry, I don't have my glasses on. Is that 635? Yeah. House Bill 635, child care and thank you, early learning providers, by Representative McFarland. Representative McFarland, you are recognized to explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members. House Bill 635 is one that you all voted on last session, and it's back again, because sometimes really good ideas need a little more time. If you don't have a child under the age of 5 in your life or recently in your life, I'll just remind you, parents have to pay for everything with all children all the time, but not education. School steps in at age 5, and under the age of 5, parents are on their own to pay for childcare, to pay for education, to pay for anything that is raising that child other than you. And I have 3 children who are under that age, so I know exactly how much it costs. And I'll tell you about the state of the market today, not only in Florida, but across the country. Childcare is hard to find and super expensive. It is the number 2 cost for homes beyond the cost of housing today. When I ran for office and I encountered this market inefficiency, I put on my good MBA hat and I thought, let's tinker with supply and demand. So that's what this bill is doing. It creates a child care tax credit for any employer that wants to partner with their employees on providing child care for either their employees' children or grandchildren. There's an incentive for employers to build their own facility. They can claim a credit up to 50% of that startup cost, or a monthly rate of $300 per child or grandchild. That's all to increase supply. To attempt to lower costs for providers, which would flow through to the parents, we've got a few things in the bill to reduce providers' property tax footprint, making them exempt from special assessments, which all of our other educational institutions are exempt from today already. And it reduces some burdensome regulations that drive up costs without directly contributing to quality education or safety of the child. There are a whole lot of details in this very long bill, but this is the overall gist of the bill, and it's my pleasure to present it to you today.
Uh, Thank you, Representative McFarland, for that explanation. Members, are there questions on the bill? Questions on the bill? Representative Roach, you are recognized for a question.
Thank you, Representative McFarland, for bringing this good child-friendly bill. I just did have one question. I'm a little concerned about the exemption from licensing for certain entities that are going to take advantage of this. Can you explain sort of the thought process behind still requiring other folks to be licensed and then exempting these people from having a license?
You recognize?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Roach. This is actually one of my favorite parts of the bill. There exists already a federal child care tax credit for employers. It is highly underutilized. Most employers see the burden of providing child care as just that, just burdensome. It's a high liability, high risk, low ROI. So in Florida, we're gonna sweeten it by saying if you build your own childcare facility where only your own employees, children or grandchildren can go, you can be what's called license exempt. It's a status that exists already in law. We extend it to faith-based providers. We're gonna make sure that that facility is still accredited, but it won't, that the facility would not have to go through all of the licensing steps that regular market providers have to go to, which is 537 points of inspection. I really like this part, so I'm gonna keep talking about it more than you might care about. But when we talk about licensing, right, as regulators, we often think if we don't provide laws about everything, children will suffer. And that's certainly something we should be cautious of when we're talking about really young kids. But if I'm commuting to work with my kid and I can pop down during lunch, I am very willing to accept a little more risk. This is not a risky environment that we're going to put children into. They still have to be accredited. But if you equate regulation to safety or quality, which I would argue against, but if you are the person who does that, I would say, if I'm commuting to work with my kid, I'm fine with that.
Questions, members? Representative Valdez, you have a question? You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Roach's question and your answer prompted this question that I'm going to ask. What about safety precautions? What about those OSHA, the facility in itself? I don't know. I just wonder how the regulation, up to where are we saying no regulation? Let's put it that way. What's going to be the minimum that they have to meet in order to open up that center?
You recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that we get to spend some time on this because I know that it feels counterintuitive. The facility would still be subject to the same fire marshal, health code, all of that, building codes, still consistent. But I mentioned 537 points of inspection. When DCF today licensed a facility, there are 537 points of inspection. That facility is inspected 3 times a year without notice. And I mean, again, I have 3 children. I want them to be the best educated and the safest they possibly can be, but there's no way you can tell me that all 537 points of inspection lead to either safety or quality education. Again, if employers want to partner with their employees to provide this service, the incentives are not there for them to do it on the cheap, right? Their incentive is there to do it as well as they possibly can. For all the risk mitigation measures that I mentioned in the beginning. The license exempt status that we would offer them through this bill is to say that we in the state of Florida are willing to partner with employers that want to help their employees solve this lack of availability of childcare.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. How about then the liability aspect to the employer? Is it something to leave up to the interpretation that if an employer decides to build a center and take care of the babes, right, and then something happens, what's the liability on that?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The regular insurance market requirements are still, we don't touch those except for one provision of the bill for large family child care providers, which is a little bit different from the employer provided. They still have to compete in the regular market to provide insurance. We're not making any special provisions there. You know, businesses know how to business.
Yeah. One more follow-up, sir?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How about the quality of the educators that are going to be in that school? Will they be licensed, or is it going to be someone that the employer says, come babysit?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, the 402-316 is an existing statute today for faith-based organizations and a couple others that offer childcare in this way that are accredited by a nationally recognized accrediting body. The preschool that my own children go to are part of a NIAC instead of DCF. In addition to DCF. The national accrediting bodies that exist today, the ones that employers would take advantage of, are excellent standards of quality. Ones that I feel very comfortable with for my own children. And it still requires the 40-hour course that's consistent for all of our teachers, which is what you asked about.
So it's a DCA. They'll have...
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Scheer. So they would have to have their certification in order to be able to teach the children and or take care of them while mom and dad are at work. Okay. All right.
You're reckoning. Would you clarify just your answer?
Yeah, the brilliant Representative Valdez was exactly right. The teachers still have a education requirement they have to meet, background screening. She got it right.
Thank you. Ranking Member Escamani, you're recognized.
Thank you so much. Great to see you, Rep. And thanks for filing this bill again. And I'll talk more about in debate about the changes that I like. But I just have questions pertaining to more the tax incentives. So I'm curious. So some large companies already do provide childcare. And so how confident are we that this will incentivize new companies versus, give a tax credit to companies already doing it?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This was my concern as well. Is the carrot big enough to entice employers to the table? I mentioned the federal tax credit that exists that is underutilized. I do believe that the license exempt status will be a sweetener, so to speak. And all I can do is share anecdotes that I've heard. I've been working on this bill for 2 years now. I've talked to employers in Sarasota. I've talked to national level employers. And this was something so interesting to me. Remember, there's two provisions of this bill for tax credit. One is for employers that build their own. The other is a monthly subsidy. I assumed everyone would just go to the monthly subsidy because no one wants to build their own. It's a lot of work. The opposite is true of the big national employers, even ones who are already providing some sort of benefit. And they described it to me in the following way. They said, if we offer the monthly subsidy to our employees, then all of our employees in all of the states around the country are going to want the same thing. Say, why did the Floridians get it? But if we build our own, we're still in, unemployment is 2.5% in the state of Florida. Everyone has vacancies. If an employer builds their own center, they have this great benefit that is going to make them the number one choice of any parent. And then secondly, they don't have to offer it at all of their locations around the country.
Thank you, follow-up chair.
You're recognized.
Thank you. That's a great answer. So we have, in the bill, there's a $1 million per taxpayer cap and a $5 million overall cap for the tax credit. Is there any concern that just a small handful of taxpayers will end up claiming all the credits? So like hypothetically five really big companies and get all of them.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I absolutely have that concern. It's difficult to follow in statute, but we've tiered it based on the number of employees. So it's large employers have a small credit if they build against the fixed cost of building their own, but a larger, not infinite, but larger credit against the monthly. And the inverse is true. Small employers who could band together, by the way, if they want to build their own with another local small business owner, they have a large capital incentive, but a smaller pool for the monthly incentives. And that was my attempt to prevent what you're talking about.
Awesome. And one more question, Chair, if I can. Thank you.
I know we talked last year about this bill. One of the comments I had was, what can we do to incentivize smaller sized businesses to participate? You've already kind of outlined some of those changes. Maybe just walk us through, you know, what are some of those small business incentives so it's not just a corporate tax break, but you are trying to apply to more diverse businesses.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We were really, really clear in the language, more so than we were last year, that employers can band together. I have this beautiful vision of small employers that are, say, in a strip mall or something, and they know that there's a vacant space, and they pool together to buy it, and they can. We've given them up to $1 million a year that they could claim in tax credit if they all pool together. Most of our employers in the state of Florida are small employers, under 20 employees. How great if we had even just 3 childcare centers that popped up as a result of this credit. That was really important to me for the small employers. If you've got 5 employees, like maybe one of them has children that are that young, like that's not really exciting for that employer to be able to offer it. But again, I mentioned this, unemployment is so low in Florida and everyone has vacancies. I mean, when I graduated college, every employer was offering like hacky sacks and foosball in the break room. But now it's like, partner with me on childcare and I'll come to work for you in a heartbeat.
You're recognized.
Really quick question, just listening to your response about how does this intersect with like franchises? So for example, you have like a McDonald's that has a corporate headquarters and all the individual franchisees, which are separate businesses. How does, I mean, I guess I would want no double dipping, my first reaction, but how does that intersect in those structures? Because many of our small businesses are franchise owners too.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've given Department of Revenue some rulemaking authority. I'll have to revisit the franchise law to give you a specific answer, but I'll tell you my intent. We've capped the total tax credit available to $5 million per year. It's my dream that we burn through it in the first month, because that means that there's that many more children, whether they work for Publix or McDonald's or like Bob's Printing of Sarasota. I don't care. It's more availability of childcare. If we go back to the supply and demand that I started out the bill presentation with, I hope desperately to be back here in 2 years telling you we need to up it to $20 million. Because it's been such a success and employers want to solve this problem.
Good. Representative Caruso, our ranking CPA, to talk about tax credits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Am I on the clock?
You are not on the clock, sir. You are not on the clock.
All right. Got to get my billable hours in. Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Representative. I see that, you know, one of the things is to cut back on regulations and things like that. And was in my old district, HD 89, we had a child that was left in the back of a car and died. And one of the provisions of your bill removes the annual notification to a parent to parents about leaving children in cars. And this is a big concern of mine. And what was your rationale behind that? And how much could that possibly save a facility?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a very sleep-deprived mother of 3, I can tell you that terrifies me that I would do that someday. I left my jacket in my car, and that's not the same thing, but these things happen. It's not to say that anyone is a bad parent if they do these things. What I am saying is me signing a piece of paper 2 times a year does not change my behavior. It also doesn't increase the responsibility of the child care provider to make sure that I haven't left my child in the back of a car. It is a piece of paper that every parent in any facility, along with the flu piece of paper, we all have to sign 2 times a year. And what it looks like in practice is every parent gets a stack of paperwork. We glance over it, we sign it, and we send it in. What that looks like for the provider is they have to keep a massive filing cabinet with physical pieces of paper and make sure that every student's parent has signed it 2 times a year. And if DCF shows up one of those 3 times a year unannounced, as I mentioned, and one of those pieces of paper is missing, they get a Class 3 license violation. This is one of the 537 points of inspection that I feel does not directly contribute to safety of children or quality of education. It is not at all to take away from how serious and terrible it is for a child to be left in the backseat of the car. DCF has within their rulemaking authority provisions to make a better rule. I am very open to making better statute. I actually think Representative Bracey has a bill regarding children left in cars. Like, that's a much better way to examine it that actually changes parent behavior and keeps children safe.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got seven kids. My youngest is 24, so I'm kind of out of that loop, but except for the incidents that occurred in my thing. So I appreciate your intense knowledge of this area and your personal experience that you brought into the bill. So thank you.
It was a little bit. Representative Valdez, you're recognized. So no debate for you, CPA.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative McFarland, have you had a conversation with the Secretary of Education to see if you really think that some of those 537 points are just not conducive to the mission of what the intentions are of being able to have centers that are just for the purpose of not only just educating our kids, but keeping them safe while mom and while the parents are working or grandparents. We had the conversation with her to see what the ideas might be.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And absolutely, and it's a part of the bill as well. Section 8 of the bill talks about abbreviated inspections. This was an existing statute in law. DCF had, in my opinion, underutilized that opportunity, but 2 years ago, they did. They commissioned a big report that examined those 537 points of inspection, and I believe what they whittled it down to were 64 inspection points that were the true indicators of safety and quality education. And so there's a provision that DCF has done through rulemaking, and this bill will sort of like wind behind the sails for that, for employer providers that are in good standing to be able to do the abbreviated inspection cycle.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're saying that DCF actually dropped it down now from 537 to 64, or they're looking to do that?
You reckon?
Still 537. With the passage of this bill, it would be 535. What DCF recognized, you know, self-assessed and created was the abbreviated inspection cycle. For employers that 2 years, they have to be in good standing for 2 years. It dictates the number of class 1, 2, or 3 violations they can have without having corrected them. A couple other provisions that DCF, you know, that equal a good provider, basically. And we're gonna emphasize that through the passage of this bill.
You're welcome. Any other questions? All right, seeing none, we will now move. There is an amendment to the bill. Representative McFarland, you are recognized to explain your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill is going to align us with our Senate counterpart. It adds a safety requirement for childcare facilities around the CPR training. There was some concern that the CPR training is mostly online these days, and we want to make sure that the CPR training has been conducted in person. We clarify that the licensing exemption for employer-provided childcare is just for educational programs that are accredited. Sort of put some more guardrails around what Representative Valdez was sort of leaning on. A couple cross-references and technical changes, and then it returns a provision in current law around drop-in childcare to make sure that if you drop your kid off at like the YMCA kid care while you work out, you don't have to bring your entire medical record. And that's the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative McFarland, thank you for that explanation. Members, are there questions on the amendment? Questions on the amendment? There are no amendments to the amendment. There is no public testimony on the amendment. Is there anyone that would like to speak to the amendment? Seeing none. Members, we are in debate on the amendment. Is there any debate on the amendment? Representative Burfield, you're recognized.
Thank you. And I'd like to just start by saying thank you for all the work you've done. I will tell you, this is one of the topics that I have heard time and time again from constituents who are having this ongoing challenge. And I think the fact that as we look at it, in my very humble opinion, I think the best precautionary and protectors of the safety of our children are their parents. And so the fact, to your point, that a parent has that opportunity in which to interact with their child throughout the day creates an even higher standard of care potentially for that young person, because that employer is going to want to keep the employee. They're going to want to make sure that they have the level of confidence that their child is in a good place, a good and safe place, when they go back to work, so that they continue to do that. So thank you very much for all the work you've done.
Debate on the amendment. Representative McFarland, you are recognized to close on your amendment.
Wave close, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members, are there any objections to the amendment? Without objection, show the amendment adopted. We are now on the bill as amended. And there is a couple of public testimony on the bill as amended. Sarah Massey, Florida Chamber of Commerce. You are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here on behalf of the Florida Chamber of Commerce. And first, I really want to thank our sponsor today for her continued dedication to tackling Florida's child care crisis. Child care is a prosperity issue, it is a competitiveness issue, and it is a business issue. The Florida Chamber Foundation released a report that found that child care issues ended up in a loss of $5.4 billion every year. This is people not being able to come to work, people having to leave work early because child care is not affordable and not available. So this is a business community issue, and we just really thank you all for addressing Florida's child care crisis today. Thank you.
Thank you. Tara Reed Cherry waves in support. That was for Children's Movement of Florida, and then Tara Reed Cherry, the Learning Experience Corp. She's waving in support for both of those organizations. Michelle Watson waves in support. Melissa Nelson, United Way of Florida, waving in support. Thank you. Terry Reed Cherry, Wonder School Incorporated, she's waving in support for that organization. Matt Herndon, United Way Suncoast Tampa Bay Partnership, waves in support. Ed Briggs, Helios Education Foundation, waving in support. Thank you, Ed. Damaris Allen, Florida PTA. We've been in support. David Daniel, Florida Association for Child Care Management, speaking. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee today. It's good to see you all here in Tallahassee in this cold day. We represent the Florida Association for Child Care Management, which are your private child care providers all in your community. And as has been said here before, we're in a crisis in child care. At the end of the day, we have a capacity issue, and we have a staffing issue and a workforce issue. And that plays out through the economy when your employees can't come to work because they can't have they don't have child care available. And it all rolls downhill to the provider. If a provider doesn't have the appropriate staffing level, they're out of violation. They're out of compliance with 402-305. And so the key points, I think, in this bill are addressing capacity, both from the private child care side, our side, but it also is to increase capacity for the other businesses that choose to do this. We're not going to solve child care. There's no magic bullet, and we just need to go one at a time. We talked about, Representative, you discussed about the rules, and is the department doing anything about it? And I know you won't toot your own horn, but in your bill last year in 443, we had legislation that required the department to look at their rules and to get rid of subjectivity in their rules. The abbreviated inspections basically said, hey, we got 537 points of things that we need to check, but only 40 or 50 of these really are key indicators. Well, let's get more people into the abbreviated inspections. And so the goal of this bill and the direction of this bill is in the right track. We appreciate the sponsor for working on this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it. That is all the public testimony that was signed up to speak beforehand. Is there anyone additional in the audience that would like to speak? Seeing none. Members, we are in debate on the bill as amended. Debate on the bill. Representative Hart, you're recognized in debate.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Rep. just to know that you have helped to get it down to an abbreviated inspection number. You're smiling, but that is ridiculous. So many people have endured so many things with DCF in this inspection. They call my office all the time. I've met with DCF, gone to daycares. This is critically important just to get them to understand that 500,000 won't make a difference. It will not keep your baby safe, that there are certain things that will keep your child safe in daycare. And all of those things that they had, some of them are like a piece of paper might have been on the floor when they came into the center. It's so, thank you, thank you, thank you. And I do know how important child care is. It's because I have grandchildren and I have to help pay sometimes for daycare because it's so, so expensive. So my hope is that people will take advantage, companies, and help bill some or incentivize their employees. Will the state be doing the same thing? Can we bring our grandchildren and children to the state house and have a daycare here? That will be the next thing we need to work on. But thank you so much for your bill. I know how important it is to so many child care providers here in my district and throughout the state of Florida. So I thank you for your bill.
Thank you for your comments. Representative Barnaby, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank Representative McFarland for this tremendous bill. This is something that gives me great pride to know that the Republican Party has been pushing for families, to help families. And for all those that are minorities that are out there wondering whether or not the Republican Party cares about minorities, this bill is going to be a tremendous boost to the minority community who have a lot of families, to be frank, that need daycare. And with daycare now going to be available, it's going to, I believe, bring more prosperity to those communities. This is a game changer. And I thank the governor, Governor Ron DeSantis. And I thank...
Representative, stay to the bill, please.
I thank the leadership of, that's supporting Representative McFarland in bringing this bill. And leadership is clearly supporting Representative McFarland in this bill. And I think it needs to be said, and that's why I'm saying it, because it's important. You know, I'm a former PTA president. I know what it's like to raise children, to be running backwards and forwards and not having
Representative
child care.
Representative, please.
Tell us why
you're supporting this bill. What
I'm supporting it because it's going to help a lot of children. It's going to help a lot of children. I'm not ashamed to say it's going to help a lot of minority children. Okay? It's going to help a lot of minority children. This is very, very, very important, and it needs to be said. And I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill. I want to tell you, I have visited some of the child care facilities in my area that have gone through the certification process, and the need and the demand for them is high. I love this bill because you're going to make it better. Further, I would love to see this apply to municipal employees, first responders, essentials. This is just a huge step in the right direction. I applaud you, and I'm going to be up and urge others to be as well. Thank you.
Representative Smith, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and I'd just like to thank the rep for bringing this good bill forward. I'm certainly up on it today, and I can tell you from last session, after last session, I did like 14 town halls or just meetings with my community at different groups, and very shortly after homeowners insurance, child care was one of the top issues that people brought to me, and I visited inside my district and around Central Florida and understand the issue. This is a great bill. I really appreciate your boots on the ground perspective that you brought to the bill. I think you've made it a better bill. $5 million is a good start, but I look forward to when we're back here in a year or two and it's 10, 15, 25 million as we expand child care inside of Florida, because it is a workplace issue that is holding back. And I think one of the best pieces of this legislation is the fact that it reaches past young parents and into grandparents, because there are so many grandparents involved, still in the workforce, still working because we need them, but also that are responsible for raising those children and helping raising those children. And I think this is a great bill. Thank you for bringing it forward.
Representative Rainer, you're recognized.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And Rep. McFarland, I just want to thank you because this is bills like this is why we come to the legislature, not all the other stuff that we seem to do, but bills like this that answer questions and give solutions for our community. And much like Rep. Smith said, one of the main issues that comes up for me is childcare. I mean, while we've been in this committee hearing, I've got a text message saying, I'm watching committee. I hope that what they're doing, that this could go to municipal, yes, go ahead, girl. Go to municipal workers in Pinellas County. And that's real. These are real issues that our people want answered. And this is why we're here in Tallahassee. So I just appreciate always like your common sense approach to bills. And obviously we're working together on other stuff. So I just really just want to thank you just publicly because our kids, our families, this is not a partisan issue. This is why we're here to make sure we get things done for the people of Florida.
Thank you, Ranking Member Escamani. You're recognized.
Thank you so much. And Rep. McFarland, you already know that I really like this bill and we talked about it last session. So I'm really excited to support it. The only two thoughts I'll add is other states have pursued providing childcare to childcare providers, which that was very interesting because you mentioned just the incentive to work in childcare and our childcare providers are not paid enough and they are choosing to work in different environments versus, you know, the stress of being a childcare provider, which is often predominantly women in the field who are not paid to the skill set that we want to pay them just due to the different economics of scale and reimbursements and so forth. And so I do wonder, not in this bill, but in the future too, what can we do to also incentivize people to want to work in childcare? And I think providing coverage for their children to have childcare before they go into elementary school might be something to consider. The cost would not be too expensive for the state because it's only 0 to 4, but it would maybe make it easier for someone to be a childcare provider when they're raising their own children. The second thought I'll add is the private sector can and should play a big part in this, but end of the day, I think as a state, as a country, we also need to play a bigger role. And other modern countries around Europe, this is so common. It's not a question that childcare is provided in different means, but it is there for you because everyone sees the value in helping families be healthy, strong, and supported. So I think this is a really great step in the right direction, but I encourage all the members to continue thinking about it in a larger scale. It's a huge state. Folks who are self-employed don't necessarily get to tap into this. So there is still a large workforce that doesn't get to benefit from their employer just because of the very nature of their jobs. Now, of course, if you work remote and at home, maybe childcare isn't the biggest need, but every family is so different. So do you want to just provide some of the nuance for folks as well? Thank you so much.
Representative Valdez, did you want to debate? Oh, you're good. Okay. We're in debate, members. Any other debate? Seeing none. Representative McFarland, you are recognized. Close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a very selfish bill. I wrote it for myself. I thought it would help me. And it just so happens that my plight is the same plight of most parents of young kids, or, you know, grandparents as well. I think that's the benefit about having people in the legislature that are at different points in their life and different experiences. Is sometimes we write our own bills and they end up helping the people that we represent. The idea that put this in my head was I heard about a McDonald's that a bunch of moms hired a high schooler to come watch their babies in the break room so they could work a shift. Now, I mentioned that you're on your own if your kid's under the age of 4. You're not. If you're at a very low income level, you can apply for tuition assistance. And I think if you work at McDonald's, you probably qualify. But these moms there was a government subsidy available to them and they didn't go through it. They just found a teenager to watch their kids in the break room. And all I could think about is like the win-win-win across the board if employers are coming to the table. It's a win for kids who, instead of sitting in a break room with a tablet, are in a learning environment. We know that contributes to kindergarten readiness, which many of you work in the early learning space, you know how important that is for follow-on success in life. It helps parents. A common refrain on the Sarasota Moms Facebook group is, I can't afford to work because childcare is so expensive. I have to stay home even though I want to work, I need to work. I cannot afford to work because childcare is so expensive. So it helps parents. And it also helps employers. I know I've said this a number of times. Every employer has a vacancy right now. And if they could compete, if I was applying for jobs outside of the house and I had 10 jobs in front of me, and I would take a 20% pay cut just to have childcare that was convenient and that I could, you know, commute with my kid, visit my kid, and have it accessible and available to me. So whether you're doing it for the moms, the kids, or the employers, I urge you to support this bill. Thank you very much, members, for your support.
Representative McFarland, having closed on her bill, Rosa, please call the roll on House Bill 635 and announce the vote.
Chair McClain.
Yes.
Vice Chair Buchanan.
Yes.
Majority Whip Lamarca.
Yes.
Ranking Member Escamani.
Yes.
Representatives Alvarez.
Yes.
Bankson.
Yes.
Barnaby.
Yes.
Burfield.
Yes.
Campbell.
Yes.
Caruso.
Yes.
Costello. Duggan. Fabricio.
Yes.
Hart.
Absolutely. Yes.
Holcomb.
Yes.
Killebrew.
Yes, ma'am.
Rayner.
Yes.
Roach.
Yes.
Robinson.
Yes.
Roth.
Yes.
Saroy.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Tant.
Yes.
Valdez.
Yes.
22 yeas, 0 nays.
Members, by your vote, we will show House Bill 635 reported favorably. Congratulations, Representative McFarland. Now, members, we will move on to House Bill 727, tax exemption for disabled ex-service members by Representative Amnesty. Representative, thank you for your patience this afternoon, and you are recognized to explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, Ranking Member, and committee members for the opportunity to present before you all this afternoon. The purpose of House Bill 727 is to increase the value of the ad valorem tax exemption for disabled veterans from $5,000 to $10,000. In 2002, it was increased from $500 to $5,000. Since then, it has not been increased. Currently in 2024, we see a massive increase in property value, insurance, and expenses. For that cause, it is imperative that we increase the exemption from $5,000 to $10,000 to align the exemption with our current economic state. Our veterans need our support now more than ever. That is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Amnesty, for your explanation. Members, are there questions on the bill? Any questions on the bill? Seeing none, there are no amendments. There is public testimony. Bob Astolosa from Florida Department of Veterans Affairs. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it. Good seeing you today. Is there any additional public testimony? Seeing none. Is there debate on the bill, members? Any debate? You are recognized to close, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill is important. We must honor our veterans and align the exemption with the current economic state of the country. Florida is the most military and veteran-friendly state in the nation. Through this legislation, we will be ensuring that our veteran exemptions align with today's economy. And with that, I close.
Representative Amnesty, having closed on her bill, Rosa, please call the roll on House Bill 727 and announce the vote.
Chair McClain.
Yes.
Vice Chair Buchanan.
Yes.
Majority Whip Lamarcus.
Yes.
Ranking Member Escamani.
Yes.
Representative Alvarez.
Yes.
Bankson.
Yes.
Barnaby.
Yes.
Burfield.
Yes.
Campbell.
Yes.
Caruso.
Yes.
Costello. Duggan. Fabricio.
Yes.
Hart.
Yes.
Holcomb.
Yes.
Killebrew.
Yes, ma'am.
Rayner.
Yes.
Roach.
Yes.
Robinson.
Yes.
Roth.
Yes.
Saroy.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Tant. Valdez.
Yes.
21 yeas, 0 nays.
Members, by your vote, we will show House Bill 727 reported favorably. Congratulations, Representative. And again, thank you for your patience today. Members, our next authorized meeting time is Wednesday, January 31st at 9 o'clock in the morning. We probably will have a fairly robust agenda, so be prepared. Representative Holcomb, moves we rise without objection, show the meeting adjourned.